accession number 31509, Rule 6.
Working. Let me see. That's going. Gavin Douglas, Rule 6. Yes, I was going to ask you, Gavin, if you wouldn't mind repeating this. The differences with being in the RAF of sort of ethos, culture, between the RAF and the Army.
Yes. Well, so much that was happening at that time was less based on past history, past experiences, and background of a person. All these were very important in the Army in the old days. It was becoming what was called a meritorious society. And the RAF particularly, had to recruit quickly. And their way of recruiting was to invite anybody who wanted to go into the Air Force after they had immediately medically examined him to see that his reflexes were fully functional and that he didn't have any history of mental problems in the past or in his family. In other words, a clean, healthy chap. Didn't matter what his education was or up to certain limits. They took on anybody who could be trained to fly an airplane, who was, in other words, a quick learner, even if he had very little learning behind him. The result was, of course, people from all walks of life, mainly from the lower walks of life, found their way in as sergeant pilots in the Air Force. If they couldn't, they were the only ones who became sergeant pilots straight away were those who were selected for training as pilots. The RAF, of course, took in lots of other people. Of course, there were more people in the ground services than there were in the Air Force, in the flying service, to keep the airplanes flying.
So did you notice there was a difference in standards, say, between the RAF and the Army?
Not between the senior officers and the RAF, who, after all, had all been educated in the same way as we newcomers were in the Army. They'd been to public schools and they'd been to universities, and they'd come from the same kind of family backgrounds. But those that were more recently, those who recruited during the war, they were taken from all walks of life. And many of them had very little education, but were smart and quick learners, and were given a chance that they would never have otherwise had of seeing how they could do and quickly rise to the top. This happened in many cases.
I suppose there would also have been differences within the between the army regiments, would there?
Oh, very much so. The army was there are all sorts of levels in the army. It sounds puerile now to mention, but they were very much in effect. For example, the guards officers and the cavalry officers. Very seldom spoke to officers of line regiments, foot regiments. It doesn't mean to say that the brothers of some of them might not have also been in a good line regiment. And the good line regiments, of course, didn't speak very proudly of the ones that were not considered so good. And I'll give you an example. The Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire regiment, which had an excellent war record in the First World War, and as it turned out, an excellent record of service in the Second War, between the wars was considered the absolute end. Nobody would go to the Beds and Hearts if they could possibly help it. I've never been able to quite fathom why this was, but it was a fact. The Beds and Hearts were the bottom. The county regiments were considered the next best, and of course, there were the famous Scottish Line regiments and some of the Welsh regiments, which were in every way equivalent culturally in that to the officers and the cavalrymen. But the saying, if you ride on a horse all your life, you're riding heads and shoulders above everybody else, and that's the way you felt. It was passed on.
I suppose the RAF was also a relatively new outfit,
absolutely,
wasn't it?
In fact, at the end of the Great War, including Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, they said, well, we don't need the Air Force anymore. We'll scrap it completely. And Hugh Trenchard, who was the charge of he was an ex-army officer himself, of course, was a man who was the father of the Royal Air Force, which is what the RFC became. And through his exertions in Longsight, we have the Air Force nowadays, which is one of our premier services, much better than our old infantryers and carriermen than would have that would otherwise have been the case. Well, we would have had a much younger Air Force.
So would you say the RAF at this time, you know, that the time you were talking about when you went in, was more democratic than the Army?
Yes, I have used that expression before several times. In the sense that I used it, the squadron commanders and the pilot officers underneath them, there wasn't that gulf that there was in the Army between the senior officers and the regiment and the junior officers. It was subtle. It wasn't something you would find everywhere, but there was a general feeling that you could say and do much more as you wanted to, as a young man, than you dared say in your regiment, which is absolutely—that's not on. You know, you don't talk about things like that. The Air Force discussed everything freely. Now, they didn't have the rules about no religion, no women, and no shop in the mess. And otherwise, it stinks all around. They didn't have that. So we did. In fact, it was instilled to you from the moment you made your first mistake. You found you were buying a round of drinks for the whole all the officers.
So how did you settle in, you know, having been so long in the Army? How did you take to the being in the RAF?
I'm a very adaptable person and had no problem at all.
So could I ask you about your first operational training, where you were sent?
Yes, well, I myself was sent to Petah Tikva, which is close to Tel Aviv, and the course, as I remember, was about 6 or 7 weeks long, and the course at Petah Tikva was particularly suitable for people going into what used to be called the Army Cooperation Squadrons, which became known later as Tactical Reconnaissance Squadrons, and they were closer to the Army than the plane fighter pilot, because they were always working in conjunction with the Army. And it was a natural thing for me as an ex-Army officer to have my Army expertise in a unit which was going to deal mainly with close support to the Army.
And what sort of planes did you train on?
We trained on, first of all, on Hurricanes, which were going out of service by that time. In the later marks of Spitfire were coming in. This Hurricane was, for its purpose, was better than the Spitfire. The Spitfire, for its purpose, was better than the Hurricane. I mean, aircraft were designed for certain things. Spitfires are for high altitude, speed, agility, and dealing with other fighters, and also pumping lead into the bombers. And they could reach an altitude greater than that reached by Hurricanes, which made them very useful when the enemy came in very high up. But when it came to softening up the enemy on the ground, and Army cooperation, and bombing and strafing them in low positions, the Hurricane carried a bigger bomb load, had four cannons, and was a much more effective weapon against troops on the ground. Together, they worked very well. But one, you couldn't ask a Hurricane to do a Spitfire's job, nor would you ask a Spitfire to do a Hurricane. Having said which, that was always happening. One or the other was also being asked to do something that they were not really built for. People, the name Spitfire caught on very, very much. Even the Germans spoke with awe, Spitfire, but they never said the same thing about Hurricanes. But Hurricanes won the Battle of Britain, there's no doubt about it. And they could take more punishments. In fact, one of them saved my life later, but that's another story.
Yes, we'll come to that. I think that's an important story. But it is interesting what you're saying, that each designer plane has a purpose.
Oh, absolutely.
And has to be judged on their performance for that purpose.
Exactly. You can't say a Spitfire is better than a Hurricane. For what? Yes, for some things. Much better. But no damn good for what a Spitfire was, what a Hurricane was very good for. And a Spitfire could touch. And you can ask a Spitfire to get up as hard as a Spitfire in the altitude business, because it wasn't designed for it. Its engine needed more oxygen. It wasn't quite as fast. It carried greater weight. You know, all those things.
And you were actually flying both of these, were you?
Oh, you started on it, because the Hurricane was considered a little easier to fly, technically, as flying goes. As far as everything else is concerned, with knowing all about the controls and that, there was no difference. But we started off on Hurricanes, and they would preferred us to write off a Hurricane in training, I mean, probably ourselves too, than a Spitfire. But after about, I think it did a few hours on a Hurricane, and then you were converted onto Spitfires. By converted, I mean you had to learn until you knew it blindfold exactly where every knob and gauge was in the aircraft blindfold. So that in the event of smoke in the cockpit or darkness at night, electrics going, you couldn't see anything, you knew where everything was. That was part of the training. Handing, of course, was another thing. Aerobatics are very important. Taking an aircraft in training to its stresses, which impose great stresses on you yourself, even in small aircraft. If you pull it into a very tight bend too quickly, you can black out. And the same with a faster airplane. You can't turn so quickly because of its speed. But in turning, you build up enormous forces of gravity, and all the blood drains out of your head and goes down into your tummy and into your leg, and you can't see a thing. And it's only when you release the pressure on pulling around or pulling up from a dive that your sight comes back again, and you go through what's called grey out first of all, and that you're still conscious, and you can then release the gravity effect on you to see what you're doing again. Or if you don't, you'll black out completely, and you won't know what the hell you're doing until subconsciously or consciously your body relaxes and you let go of the controls a bit, and the g-forces decrease, you see again, and you suddenly realize what's happened. You've got used to it. You know, well, I know I'm going to black out for 2 or 3 seconds completely in this tight, so you hold it tight for that, and then you're conditioned to let it go and come out. So it was a thing you learned.
And very quick thinking, I would think, at the speeds
This is why young men, it didn't matter what your background was, provided they were physically fit, they would do all these things. They could do more easily than people who were not young men and quick learners and all that thing.
Was there any trouble in Palestine while you were there near Tel Aviv?
Absolutely none at all. But what is interesting is that the Arabs were so friendly, and the Israelis were unfriendly. I'll give an example. I'm not criticizing, but we had transport, RAF transport, which would take pilots on rest or at the end of the day down to the officers' club at Jaffa, which is some 30 miles away. And if you missed the Air Force bus, which was free, of course, you stood at the gate and you tried to thumb a lift. An Arab going by with his old Ford truck with vegetables in the back would stop, and if he could, he would give you a lift if he was going your way. The Israelis never. I never once went into an Israeli house for a meal or anything. Arabs were always inviting us to feasts in their villages. It was always lamb or goat, you see, and sheep's eyeballs and all that sort of thing in a stew. I mean, it wasn't every day, but it was always they were friendly. They were nice. But the having said that, the Jewish girls loved us. We danced with them. We took them out. We went swimming with them. And some of them were absolutely lovely. You wouldn't have known that they were a different race. But their brothers and their parents, I would say, we never saw at all. They didn't seem to get into hot water. I wouldn't know what went on behind, but they never seemed. They came out just as though everything was all right at home. And there were no liberties taken in those days, sexually, and people getting drunk or being made to get drunk in order to cohabit or anything of that sort. But they were female company, and they were fun to go down to the beach with and that sort of thing, and to dance with, and to neck a bit, and all that sort of thing. But there was never any question, never would have entered my mind that this girl is so nice and so sweet and so well-educated and pleasant and company, and I'd like to marry her. Because there was always in the background that you could not marry somebody of another faith. That was in my mind anyway. And so that side always was right. But everything else was fine. And you kept that side of it. So it never entered your mind anyway. And in wartime, you were only there for a course for 7 or 8 weeks. There was no possibility of ever seeing the girl again when you went off to your squadron, even if you survived the war. There might have been the odd romance, which did survive. I don't know if I'm, but that love of the kind of thing, that can happen.
So after this...
There was no anti-Jewish animosity or sentiment as far as we were concerned, but we were rather hurt. I would think, which is the best way to say it, that the Jewish men were not friendly. We never met them face to face, and they were rude to us. I'm not saying that, but they were unlike the Arabs, who were simpler and happy and friendly folk. We never saw the Jewish men. Of course, we were on an air base, so we wouldn't see any of that. In any case, and the subordinate staff, cleaners and all that, they were all the Arabs. They wouldn't be Egyptian, wouldn't be Jewish at all. So we really never rubbed shoulders, except through the female side.
And this, I imagine, would be before the period of terrorism, wouldn't it,
yes,
in the area?
Yes. That came after the war. Mm.
Yes. So this would have been the end of your training, would it?
That was the end of my training.
Yes. How would you assess your overall training?
Well, I don't know.
Was it adequate for what you were later to do in Burma?
Oh, yes. I have my logbook. It says I was above average.
And where was your first posting then?
I was posted back to India, first of all. And I was given 10 days disembarkation leave. Well, it wasn't disembarkation, we flew back. Before, I was given 10 weeks leave. 10 days leave. Before reporting to the to a collection centre in Pune, from where we waited to be posted to squadrons. It was called an RFU, and it was at Pune, about quite close to Bombay, and up in the hills. Went down south, saw my wife, saw my second son for the first time. He was born whilst I was actually in Palestine. He was born in October, and went to Pune, and in about 10 days' time, during which time they had a small airfield there and hurricanes and so forth, you were allowed to go every day, sign in, and take an aircraft up. So you didn't lose the touch, just for aircraft familiarity. So you went up with a Spitfire, flew around the countryside, and came down again, went to the mess. It was just killing time. I was posted to 28th Squadron in Burma. Actually, when I joined, it was just after Imphal and Kohima. And at the time when the Japanese started their retreat, so lucky to get there before that because, well, for obvious reasons. My first station with the RAF was at Tamu, which actually was on the Indian side of the Burma border, but I was only there for 2 days, and almost immediately, we were ordered to go to a place called Kalemio, which was down in the valley inside Burma, and a very unhealthy place, as was Kalewa. And I didn't actually fly down. The squadron pilots with the squadron flew their aircraft down, and I went down with the road transport, being a newcomer. And it was an amazing journey in Air Force, big Air Force trucks, driving down these tortuous mountain roads, dangerous as anything, through the Valley of Death, where so many thousands, tens of thousands, not refugees, but people trying to escape from Burma, Indians and British wives, children, were trying to escape the Japanese as they entered Japan from the east and from the south at the beginning of the Burmese War. I remember as it became daylight, as we went through this valley, Kabul was the name of the place, seeing parts only could be seen because the jungle had almost reclaimed them. They'd been pushed off to the side of the road and trees were growing up through them, but the rusted and burnt out remains of the vehicles that had got them so far, then they ran out of petrol and then they had to walk. And there were in the jungle, I didn't ever go to inspect them, and we were driving down the road. But it was called the Valley of Death, not because of what had happened at that time, but because it was a very malarial area. And the two things stuck, and it's still called the Valley of Death. The Kabul Valley. K-A-B-A-W.
K-A-B...
A-W.
A-W.
Kabul.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that must have been quite an introduction.
Yes, it was. Well, of course, I joined the squadron and was introduced to Henry Larson, who, funnily enough, was a Jewish boy from London, who was a squadron commander, a very good pilot, a very nice chap, and the only all-officer squadron still in the Air Force. All the other squadrons had a certain number of sergeant pilots, warrant officer pilots, and of course officer pilots. But the 28th Squadron, which had been in India since about 1924, and only Saabs flew planes in those days, and so they only took Saabs, and Saabs couldn't be anything other than a pilot officer, and from there on was up, no sergeant pilots flew, not another. It was a Saab's job. And so in those days, the squadrons that were in India remained all officer squadrons. 20th Squadron was another, but they changed sooner. A very well-organized squadron, as any squadron who had been out east. They knew all the form, they knew all the things. Other squadrons that came out from the Middle East and from England, they were taros arriving in a foreign country who didn't know where to turn, what to do. Everything behind any teak tree in the jungle was menace and all that. Not so with 28th Squadron. They knew the jungle can be as friendly as one's back garden. But it was a psychological thing, I was saying.